Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, FTC, Universal and DJ Khaled. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Good afternoon.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last 7 days, a week when Radiohead fended off a hacker threatening to release a whole load of unreleased music if they didn't pay a ransom by releasing that music themselves.
Music in inverted commas, because it's a lot of stuff from demos and sessions.
I think it's music. I don't think they would dispute that it's music.
Not necessarily both music Johnny, you'd want to listen to.
Both Johnny Greenwood and Tom York said it was boring, basically.
And imagine if Tom York thinks it's boring, it's got to be pretty damn boring.
A lot of journalists have said it is not. And I think it is of great interest to a lot of, certainly, Radiohead super fans.
It's 18 mini discs worth.
Yeah, more than 16 hours of music.
That was the question I was going to ask you. Can you remember how much content everyone you can get on a mini disc?
Yeah, well, everyone was reporting that it was over 18 hours, but it's not, you can get more than an hour on a mini disc, but not every mini disc contained a full 70 whatever minutes. Some of them were shorter. So it was over 16 hours of music in total, and it was all basically the demos and extraneous bits and pieces that the band worked on in the kind of pre-production process before they went into the studio and recorded OK Computer.
So that dates it to the mid-90s?
Something like that, yeah. What are they, OK Computer, was that 97?
I would say something like that.
They recently had an anniversary release, maybe it was 98.
Did we ever get quite to the bottom of what had happened? Because there was a tweet that implied that there had been some blackmail and some extortion, which was, if you don't give us this money, we'll put this on the internet. But then on Reddit, there were Radiohead fans who'd been told that they'd been offered to buy it or buy tracks from it or something like that.
Yeah, the story had emerged a few days previous to this when Radiohead fans on Reddit started saying, I've been approached by someone trying to sell me this massive archive of recordings from OK Computer. And some people were saying they're asking for $150,000 for the lot. Some people were saying they were selling individual tracks. It was like $800 for a studio recording and maybe like 50 quid for a live recording, because there were some sound check recordings and things like that, and live performances in there as well.
But why is a studio recording worth so much more than a live recording?
I guess because live...
Better quality?
I suppose live recordings are more likely to be out there as bootlegs already, probably.
True.
Whereas
good point.
The studio recordings are probably better. I mean, there was stuff like that the band members had recorded in their bedrooms, things like that. It was stuff that wouldn't be quite so easy to get your hands on. And so that came out. And then the band put all this stuff up on Bandcamp. And they sort of implied that there'd been a ransom demand. But there was the use of the word reportedly in Johnny Greenwood's tweet about it, which suggested he didn't completely know what
had
happened.
Yeah, he hadn't been extorted.
But he talked about ransom and said, you can download this stuff and you can see if we should have paid the ransom. Because they are charging for it. But they're charging £1 per mini disc's worth.
So £18 to get it all.
Yes, which is quite a lot less than $150,000.
And
even when
that,
you convert it.
Not only have they said to this hacker, ha, we're going to completely obliterate the value of this content that you've stolen by selling it dirt cheap. And not only that, they're giving the money that they raised by selling it to charity.
Yes, to the Extinction Rebellion.
So there you go. An impromptu charity release of 18 hours of nonsense. And they implied that it was going to be a short-lived release.
Yes, it's only available for 18 days.
So get it while you can.
That time is depleted by the time you hear this, although you still do have a little while to get hold of it. So go and look that up on Bandcamp. I'll probably put a link for it in the show notes for this as well. So go to setlistpodcast.com if you can't be bothered to Google Radiohead Bandcamp.
And assuming that you are listening to this podcast as soon after release as possible, because obviously if you leave it 2 weeks after this podcast comes out, then the 18 days will be up.
Yes, and if you wait 18 years to listen to this, continuing the 18 theme,
definitely won't be
available. But you will be able to probably get it from file sharing networks. Or maybe the person who stole it in the first place will still be trying to sell it.
Maybe he'll drop it down to 75 pence per disc.
Yeah.
And see if he can steal some money off charity. Not only steal the content off the band, steal some money off charity as well. Sitting on a little hard disk underneath my desk at home, so the area at home where I write my CMU stories every morning.
I understand the concept of a desk.
There's a little hard disk that has on it most, probably not all, because I'm not that conscientious, but most of the raw recordings of this podcast.
Wow.
So maybe
well,
one day that'll get stolen or hacked. And we too will be on the receiving end, because I'm sure the unedited set list archives would be pretty much as equally sought after as the OK Computer recording sessions. So that's something to look forward to. We'll have to have a think about which charity we will pick.
I think if some of the things that have been edited out of this show get out into the world, that could be problematic for us. So hopefully we don't get hacked.
But that is not what we're here to talk about.
No.
Radiohead hacks are not one of, what did you say, biggest and most interesting? Was that how you define the stories on this podcast?
Yeah.
So not one of the biggest and most interesting stories.
Well, I said both Johnny Greenwood and Tom York said that this music was all boring.
Well, the music could be boring, but the story could still be interesting.
We're releasing this for charity, but don't listen to it. It's rubbish.
But what stories were both bigger and more interesting than the Radiohead hack?
Well, we are going to be discussing Universal's denial that it covered up the loss of up to 500,000 original master recordings in a fire 11 years ago, and DJ Khaled setting his lawyers on Billboard over his US chart position. But first, killing the bots and declaring the fees were the two key talking points during a full-day debate on the American ticketing market organised by the US Federal Trade Commission on Tuesday last week.
Yeah, so we knew that this full-day debate, they called it a workshop, but it was just experts talking in a sort of panel-type setup.
That's with an audience.
Not really a workshop, is it? We knew this big debate about the ticketing market in the US was coming up because, do you remember last year?
I remember last year.
Do you remember last? All of it.
Yeah.
Every single minute of it. Do you remember the minutes?
Yep.
When we reported in the CMU Daily, we probably talked about it on Setlist as well, but I can't guarantee that.
I don't think we did.
When we talked about Ticketmaster being in the news.
Oh, that, yeah.
For various reasons.
We did talk about that on Setlist.
There were allegations of anti-competitive behaviour, and that when Live Nation and Ticketmaster merged in the US, they reached a deal with the US Department of Justice, one of those consent decrees.
Oh, yeah.
And there was allegations that they'd been breaching that consent decree and acting in an anti-competitive way. And then there was that whole thing in the Canadian press about Ticketmaster's ticket resale business in America, because although Ticketmaster has bailed on secondary ticketing here in Europe, they still have their ticket resale sites, plus a whole load of services they offer to ticket touts, or scalpers, as they call them in America. And there was a big expose about Ticketmaster's secondary ticketing business in the US and allegations that it meant that Ticketmaster were not as severe as they would say they were in stopping touts from accessing tickets from the Ticketmaster primary site. So all of these things were in the news for a few weeks last year. We talked about them on Setlist. I think you're right in saying that. We definitely reported on them in the CMU Daily. And it was around about that time that the Federal Trade Commission announced that it was going to have this full-day debate about issues in the ticketing market, not just touting, not just the secondary ticketing market, issues in the primary ticketing market as well as on the secondary side. And they said they were going to do that. I think they originally said they were going to do it in March.
Yes, but then Donald Trump shut down the government.
Yeah, FTC is part of the American government. The American government got shut down for however long it was because Trump couldn't have his wall, which meant it all got postponed. But it has now happened. It happened last week. And it's interesting for various reasons. Quite a lot of what was said by the ticketing companies who were there and the sort of political types who were there and the legal and consumer rights types that were there. Most of what was said we'd heard before, but I suppose because there has been so much debate and discussion and campaigning and lobbying about secondary ticketing in particular here in the UK and elsewhere in Europe, it's interesting to check back in on what the debate is like in America, where generally people are much more willing to defend the resale of tickets and touting and scalping.
Well, as you said, when Live Nation shut down its secondary ticketing sites in Europe, it very much did not shut them down in the US.
Because it's still big business touting over there. And as I say, there have been occasional controversies about the secondary ticketing market, including that expose in the Canadian media last year. But in the main, people accept and openly defend secondary ticketing in the US much more proactively than they would over here, following the backlash against ticket resale in recent years in the UK and elsewhere in Europe. So it was interesting, as I say, to check back in on where the debate is at in America. Also interesting to see some of the conversations around the primary market, which was also under scrutiny, and there were some complaints about the primary market, some of which I suppose are kind of specific to the way that the primary ticketing market works in the US, but also some of the complaints we get as much over here as well. So it was interesting to see the debates that were occurring, and also interesting that almost immediately, as soon as that full-day debate had happened, some new legislation was filed. I say new. It's kind of old legislation refiled in Congress in Washington, which we'll also talk about. But I guess, what were the standout talking points of this FTC workshop, as they called it, on ticketing?
Well, the two big talking points that came out of it were around bots and fees. So ticketing bots, that being the software that touts can use to hoover up tickets from the primary ticketing market before actual fans can get hold of them and then put them straight onto the secondary market, those are officially banned in the US.
Yeah, you might be wondering why that was still part of the conversation, because it's like 3 years ago now. It was one of the last things that Obama signed into law. We had the, all laws in America have stupid names, don't they? Was it the Bots Act?
It was the Bots Act, yeah.
And they managed to get the Bots Act by having something that was then an acronym, BOTS.
Ban old ticketing scalpers.
That doesn't work.
Something like that.
Oh, it does work.
Or ticketing software?
Better online software ticketing. I don't know. Anyway, they somehow managed to have a name of a piece of legislation that when acronymized, is that a word?
No.
When initialized, spelled out the BOTS Act, and that was passed.
Initialized is a word, but it means something else.
That happened in 2016. So officially, bots have been illegal. The use of this software by touts has been illegal. And that was federal law, as I say, signed into law by Obama. Most ticketing regulation in the US is at state level.
Yeah.
And in some states, there have been some attempts to crack down on secondary ticketing. Actually, in other states, the opposite of that. There have been laws passed to stop promoters from stopping the resale of their tickets.
Yeah.
But most of that's happened at state level. But we did actually have a bots ban in the US, like we also did here in the UK and a bunch of other countries as well. But it happened at a federal level. So in theory, bots have been outlawed for 3 years. Why are we still talking about it in 2019?
Well, the argument at this debate was that the punishments aren't harsh enough when you do contravene that law. So people just still do it because it's no big thing if you get caught. And probably people don't get caught anyway.
Yeah, so although that law from 2016 allows the FTC, as it happens, to fine touts who use that software, basically what people were saying was, the fines aren't severe enough. It should be a criminal offence. There should be criminal penalties for doing it. And in the absence of that, plenty of touts were still using the bots. I think it was the Ticketmaster representative who was there confirmed that they were still having to employ their own technology to try and stop the bots from getting through and trying to stop lots of tickets being sold to individuals who are using that software. So on the primary side, they certainly are still seeing the bots attacking their platforms to try and buy up those tickets. Of course, there is also the issue that what can the FTC do about touts outside the US?
Yeah.
Back to the classic limitation of any law to do with internet stuff, that the borders come into the way. And some people have said, and it was interesting watching the various bloggers and journalists who wrote up this FTC workshop, because some were on the consumer rights side, down on various things about ticketing and particularly ticket touting. But then there were some write-ups which were very much from defenders of touting looking at this. And across all of that, some were saying with the bots ban, even if you could enforce it, even if there were decent penalties, the touts can still hire teams of people to be manually buying tickets. And okay, that's slightly more expensive than having a bit of software doing it, but not so much more expensive that it will put the industrial touts off. So I think some people would argue the bots ban is often presented as being a solution, and really it's only a really small step towards reducing the amount of ticket touting.
And people on both sides of the argument tend to support a bots ban because, well, if you're anti-secondary ticketing, you definitely want to stop touts from just automating the buying up of tickets en masse so that real fans can't get them. And then if you're on the secondary ticketing side and you support that industry, it's an easy PR win to say, oh yeah, we should definitely stop using that software. That software is bad. And try to focus the argument on that and then not talk about anything else.
Yeah, cynics would say one of the reasons why the StubHubs of this world have always been supportive of bots bans in the US, in Europe and elsewhere is it's a distraction technique. Let's hone in on that specific argument and then distract people from regulating secondary ticketing in other ways.
Yeah, and as these secondary sites always say, though, you know, we're just a platform where a music fan who finds themselves with a spare ticket can sell that ticket on, maybe at a profit, maybe not. It makes sense for them to say, well, of course, we don't want people buying up tickets with software and selling them on because that's not what we're about. Whereas we do know that the vast majority of tickets being sold on these platforms are sold by a small number of ticket touts rather than a large number of individual fans who've got one spare ticket.
But yes, the conclusion of the conversation at this FTC event was, although we have a bots ban, it's not working, and if we want it to work, let's say some people would say it's a bit of a distraction anyway, but if we want it to work, they were saying, then you need to have much, much, much tougher penalties in law so that actually the FTC can really start cracking down.
As for the fees discussion, that relates to primary and secondary ticketing sites. It's a thing that's been an issue for a long time, and that consumers really don't like it. When you go on a ticketing site, it tells you the price of the ticket, and then when you come to the end of the transaction process, suddenly there's a load of extra fees on there that you weren't aware of, and it bumps the price up.
Yes, I mean, that's been a talking point in other countries as well, including here in the UK. A few years back, there was a lot of pressure for the primary ticketing sites in this country to stop doing that and to declare on the first screen of the transaction what the total price was going to be. So any fees, whether they are the booking fee or the distribution fee or the payment processing fee, whatever fees are, they come up with some novel fees, don't they?
Well, the one on Ticketmaster has always been the fee to print your tickets at home yourself.
Yes, the print out your own tickets using your own paper and ink fee. And so there's been long been an argument that, okay, I mean, in some ways, why are we even having all of these fees? If it costs Ticketmaster £12 to sell you a ticket, then the ticket should just be £12 more expensive to start with. And then the promoter, in essence, pays Ticketmaster out of the money that they make, is one argument. But the way the live music industry is set up, particularly in the US, the fees are a necessary part of it. Because generally, Ticketmaster is only earning from those fees. It's not getting a cut of the face value. And actually, quite often, other people involved in the show, like the artist promoter, are also sharing in Ticketmaster's fees. So the way the live sector is set up, it would actually be quite hard to get rid of those fees without radically changing all of that. But even if we're accepting the fees have to be there, yeah, why are we not being told what all the fees are going to be on the first screen before we've clicked any buttons, before we've filled out any forms? And actually, as I say, here in the UK, there was an initiative on the primary ticketing side to start doing that. On the secondary ticketing side, last year, the Advertising Standards Authority here in the UK made a number of demands of StubHub, Viagogo, etc. And that was one of them, which was you should be really upfront from the minute I land on your site what the total price is going to be. But that hasn't actually happened in the US yet. And it was interesting that everyone talked about this. Various ticketing websites, both primary and secondary, were involved in that section of the day. And they all pretty much seemed to agree, yeah, we really ought to be declaring all the fees up front, and then kind of saying to the politicians in the room, if you could make that law, that would really help us. I think it was StubHub said they'd experimented with it, with putting the fees up front, but that meant that people browsing around the internet for tickets would see the StubHub price, which had all the fees in, and then another site's price, which didn't have all the fees in, not understand the difference, and therefore assume that StubHub was more expensive, and go with the other people.
Yes, so it seemed to be a point that in the room, all of the ticketing companies were just saying, yeah, if you could legislate for this, that would really help us, because no one wants to be the first person to do it. Because as that example shows, if you are the first person to do it, it gives everyone else a competitive advantage. And so if there was legislation to make everyone do it at the same time, then that wouldn't happen.
We will now test whether the representatives of these ticketing sites were genuine in saying, actually, we would support a new rule that forced us to declare all the fees up front. Because within a couple of days of this workshop happening, we had a new piece of legislation proposed in Washington that has a bunch of new rules proposed for both primary and secondary ticketing. But one of those is, for both sides, declaring all the fees up front.
Yeah, so Congressman Bill Pascrell, who has actually been pushing for legislation on ticketing for a long time now, the best part of a decade, has launched, or relaunched really, his proposed legislation on the ticketing market. I think it's still called the BOSS Act.
Yes, the reason it's called the BOSS Act is, you mentioned he's been campaigning on ticketing, secondary ticketing, against Ticketmaster in particular, for years now. And this piece of legislation was first proposed, albeit in a slightly different form, 10 years ago. And if you've been following the secondary ticketing saga as long as we have, to the rise of online ticket touting, one of the big moments, certainly in the American side of the story, was in 2009, when Ticketmaster, which by that point already had its secondary site Tickets Now up and running, was the official primary seller for a bunch of Bruce Springsteen shows, hence the BOSS, you see. And the Ticketmaster site, which was selling those tickets, was under strain, it was stalling, and it started sending Springsteen fans over to Tickets Now, where touts were already selling tickets, but at marked up prices, even though, although the Ticketmaster site was struggling, there were still face value tickets available from the primary seller. And that was a big scandal at the time. Anything involving Bruce Springsteen's big news in America In New Jersey, the state where the main shows this affected were taking place, they actually changed the law just on the back of that one issue. And it was around about that time that this guy first proposed a bunch of new rules to regulate ticketing and secondary ticketing in America, hence the Boss Act. So how does he get to the Boss Act?
It's a little bit laboured. I mean, just a little bit. Let's see what you think. It's the Better Oversight of Secondary Sales and Accountability in Concert Ticketing.
Yes,
Boss Act. So in fact, he's got Act in there as well. So it's Boss Act Act.
Yes, the Act bit's even in the acronym. So I think there have been various versions of this over the years since the first attempt in 2009. But the new version covers a bunch of things that were talked about at this FTC event last week. So it has the making sure that everybody declares the full fees up front. It doesn't have any bot stuff in there anymore. I think the original version did, because, of course, technically, bots are already illegal under federal law. But I suppose when it comes to touting, the interesting thing is it doesn't seek to stop touting. In fact, the opposite. It seeks to put into law that buyers of tickets definitely have the right to resell those tickets and that promoters of shows can't do anything, like what they do over here in the UK, which is to threaten to cancel resold touted tickets. This law, if it was passed, would say that promoters were not allowed to do that. It does then have a few extra requirements of the secondary sites in terms of transparency, which again are similar to rules that are already in force here in the UK.
Well, things like ensuring that the seller of the ticket actually has it physically there with them rather than trying to sell it speculatively, or if they don't have it, then stating that on the listing.
And then things like making sure that the face value of the ticket is included in the listing on the site and the seat number or the zone in the venue that it relates to, and making sure that the customer knows they're buying it off a reseller, not off a primary agent, which are all things which are now in UK law. And so although it wouldn't seek to stop secondary ticketing, actually the opposite, to make sure that people have the right to resell their tickets, there is then a bunch of new rules for the secondary sites that replicate what's happened here in the UK. But the other thing is very quickly worth noting, in the bit for primary ticketing sites, one thing which is a specific conversation that comes up in America, more so than anywhere else, is forcing the primary ticketing companies and the promoters they work with to admit up front how many tickets they're putting on sale on the primary site to start with.
Mm.
And the reason for that is, I mean, here in the UK, let's say you've got a 10,000 capacity arena. Generally speaking, here in the UK, the promoter would set aside some of those tickets to go to a pre-order for like the mailing list or the fan club. Some tickets would be set aside for industry people, for the label, for press, for media, etc. And then obviously some promoters, some venues, some artists have commercial relationships. So the obvious one here in the UK is all those O2 venues, all the venues that have an O2 logo stuck on the front. And generally, as part of those venue sponsorship deals, O2 get a certain allocation of tickets that they can then sell to their customers ahead of the official on sale date. So a portion of the tickets are not actually going on general release. And in the UK, I mean, it could be 10, 15, maybe even 20% of the tickets. But in the US, because they have a lot more commercial partnerships, all the venues seem to have alliances with credit card companies for some reason. So like Citibank or the other credit card companies. And by the time they've given the allocation to the mailing list and they've given the allocation to labels and press and then an allocation to the venue and an allocation to all the brand partners and the credit card partners, it could be more than half the tickets have been allocated in that way. So by the time the tickets actually go on general release, 60% of the tickets have already gone.
Yeah.
And the secondary sites like to criticise that and say, see, the reason why fans can't get access to tickets isn't because of the touts, it isn't because of the bot using touts, it's because the devious promoters have already allocated all the tickets to all these other people before they go on sale. And there should be a much more transparency about that. And on one level, the secondary ticketing people are right to say that, although, again, a cynic would say plenty of evidence suggests that the touts get into the fan mailing list. They get on the Citibank list. And so actually, of that 60% of tickets that are being allocated elsewhere pre-release, a portion of those are going to the touts that then end up on the secondary market. So actually, it is all interconnected. But in this act, there is a new obligation if it was to go through. I mean, he's had various attempts to get this through and it hasn't worked so far. So who knows whether or not it will work this time. But there would be an obligation on the primary sites to say, of our 10,000 capacity venue, actually, we're only putting 4,500 tickets on sale.
Yeah, so it does remain to be seen if Pascrell can get this proposed act through this time. Although the fact that the FTC's had this big debate, and certain support for new measures has come out of the ticketing industry from that debate. And that would suggest that he's got a better chance this time of actually making something happen.
Although I think there are a number of things in his proposals which the ticketing sector will object to.
Yeah.
So it depends how much flexibility there is to take those out. And yes, in theory, although it will put it to the test, there are definitely some things in there which, last Tuesday, both primary and secondary ticketing websites seem to be saying, yeah, we'd be fine with that. So let's see if they stand by that as this legislation goes through the motions in Washington.
Still to come, why DJ Khaled might sue Billboard after his new album didn't go to number one in the US. But now, Universal has disputed an article in the New York Times which reports that the major kept secret that up to 500,000 of its master recordings were lost in a fire in 2008.
Yeah, so we spent the first half of this edition of Setlist talking about a piece of ticketing legislation which actually originated in 2009. And now we're going to spend the second part of this edition of Setlist talking about something that happened in 2008.
Yes, the biggest and most interesting stories of the last 7 days.
And then some.
Sort of, yeah.
So this all begins, well, it all begins with a big fire in 2008.
Yes.
But it's newsworthy because of an article in the New York Times about this fire in 2008. The fire itself wasn't a secret because when a big warehouse on a Hollywood film studio lot goes up in flames, people notice. So we knew that there had been a fire at the Universal Film Studio in Hollywood back in 2008. But crucially, most of the reporting at the time was about the film company's property that was stored there and what had been lost. But dating back to the days when the Universal Film Company and the Universal Music Company were the same company, Universal Music, the record label, also stored a bunch of stuff on this Hollywood site, which was also burnt to the ground. And not many people reported on that side of the story back in 2008.
No, some people did bring it up in their reporting, but Universal said, oh no. By this point, Universal Music and Universal Studios were separate companies.
And had been for like a decade or more.
Yeah, different ownership. So the label said, well, there was some stuff still in that warehouse, but actually most of it had been moved elsewhere now, and all of it had been digitized. There's really nothing to worry about.
Whereas the new New York Times article says that that was a cover-up, and actually, in this warehouse, there have been a lot of master tapes, the original recordings of Universal Music-owned albums dating all the way back to like the 1930s, but with some pretty recent recordings, as in recent as of 2008, so all the way into the 90s and even the early 2000s, and that, despite what the Universal Record Company had said back at the time, a significant number of master recordings were damaged, lost, obliterated in the fire.
Now, amongst other sources, the New York Times report cited two confidential internal reports from 2009 assessing what damage had been done. The New York Times says that one of those put losses at 118,230 master recordings. Another said it could be up to 500,000 recordings lost in this fire, which, I mean, that's vastly more than Universal ever indicated might have been lost back in 2008. I mean, I think actually, in some things, they were saying nothing had been lost.
I thought it was interesting because they had those two different documents that they were citing in this report. Once that had got translated into other people reporting on the New York Times report, you ended up with a line which was somewhere between X and Y recordings were lost in the fire. And it was kind of funny because the X was such a precise number. And then the Y was, oh, somewhere around about 500,000.
Yes, so 118,230 and just 500,000.
Yeah,
somewhere in that region. I mean, that's got to be, it's quite a big gap anyway. And it kind of shows, I don't know.
But even if it was the lower number, that's still an awful lot of master recordings. And of course, what made this so newsworthy was the other allegation of some of the legendary recordings by legendary artists that were in whichever, whatever figure it is, that were among the masters that were lost.
Yeah, because I mean, like you say, it's 1930s to kind of almost the present day. So it's like Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, R.E.M., Janet Jackson, Nirvana, 50 Cent. I mean, and it's just, I mean, there's a huge list of artists that the New York Times was saying could have lost music in the fire because they didn't know either exactly what had been lost.
Yeah, you said
they were sort
bit,
of estimating.
They knew it was a lot of masters. And then they just went and looked at the entire Universal Music roster and the roster of every record company that Universal Music has ever bought, which is a lot of record companies ever since 1930. And that ends up being a really big list. And then, of course, as soon as this article was out there, before Universal had even got their response sorted, you then had artists or the managers of artists coming out of the woodwork who were included in that possible list, some of them saying, oh, we knew our masters were lost, we just never knew why, or denying it and saying, no, actually, we've definitely got those masters, and there was lots of celebrity comment on it.
Yes, or a mix of the two, I think. I mean, there was the Questlove from The Roots was one artist who not only commented on this, but had quite a lot of conversation with fans on Twitter about it, and was saying that there's like 8 or 9 tracks from one of their albums that he's always wanted to go back and like kind of remix and release, but hasn't been able to find the tapes for it and didn't know why. But then he was saying the actual final master of that album is safe, that's stored somewhere else. So it kind of depends. There's sort of a mix of stuff that was possibly in that warehouse and stuff that's already stored elsewhere. But he wasn't the only person to say, yeah, we did know that these tapes were lost and we couldn't get hold of them. But yeah, no one's ever said, oh, they might have been lost in a big fire.
As we said out at the outset, Universal Music were adamant that the figures and some of the artists referenced in the New York Times article are wrong, incorrect.
Yes, it said there are numerous inaccuracies, misleading statements, contradictions, and fundamental misunderstandings of the scope of the incident and affected assets. While there are constraints preventing us from publicly addressing some of the details of the fire that occurred at NBC Universal Studios facility more than a decade ago, the incident, while deeply unfortunate, never affected the availability of the commercially released music, nor impacted artists' compensation. Now, I don't think the article said that those two things had happened. So that sort of doesn't matter. But, I mean, their point was that the music that those artists released is still out there. You can still listen to it. And it was saying, we've released lots of reissues, and in some cases, high-fidelity reissues of records that the New York Times is saying were lost in this fire. Now, that may be because, like they said, they digitized a lot, or indeed possibly all of it, before the fire. But then one of the things the New York Times was saying was that those tapes could have held recordings that were not released at the time and hadn't really been heard since they were originally recorded.
Because they did concede in the original article, before Universal Music even commented, that some of the masters that have been lost, although the masters have been lost, there would be copies of the recordings. There might be CDs still lying around, or they may be sitting on a hard disk somewhere. But yeah, what they were saying was, well, first of all, those copies may not be as high a quality as what was on the original master. Mm. Plus, in addition to the 10 tracks from the session that got released, what about the 10 tracks that were jammed in the studio that never got released, so probably were never on a CD, never digitised, and now those have all been lost?
Yes, no, I was saying, so in that regard, I mean, while the music may be out there in some form, there's still kind of a historical loss involved in all this.
I think the one thing which I could believe, obviously, I have no insider knowledge, and if Universal are denying it, they're denying it, and we must stress that. But I have to say, the one thing which I could believe is that no one at Universal really knew what was in the warehouse. I think that is true. I mean, one thing that we've often talked about throughout the evolution of the digital music sector, the whole iTunes boom and then in the streaming age, is although Spotify is constantly bragging that they have 50 million tracks in their system, which is a ridiculous amount of music, but a significant portion of that is relatively new, because obviously we know stupid amounts of new music is being pumped into there every day of the week now. And although there's a huge amount of music in Spotify, etc., there is still a significant portion of music released in the 20th century that has never appeared on a digital music service, or it appeared on one of the early services in a Microsoft format or a Sony A-Track format, and we've never really seen it in iTunes or in the streaming services. And of course, as we say, there's all of that rarity archive stuff that no one can quite remember. And it is true that major record companies are buying up catalogues all the time. Somebody once told me, actually, that if you buy catalogue, so you buy a record company or you buy a catalogue off another record company, you tend to value it on pretty much the top 10%. So you say, of all the music this label owns, what's the top 10% earners? And then you look at what those made last year or the last 5 years, and then you value it and you make an offer. And then you get the other 90%. And I remember somebody saying they'd been involved in an acquisition of a catalogue, and then you do the deal, you know the top 10% because that's what you valued it on, and then an Arctic lorry shows up with all the master tapes in like file boxes. It's like, what else have we bought? Because we really don't know. So I don't know if this is true. Universal Music would probably deny this, but I wouldn't be surprised if the day after that had burnt down, there were quite a few people at the record company saying, yeah, we've no idea what was in the filing cabinets and the boxes.
Well, there was the suggestion that actually all the files saying what was on the tapes was also burned in the fire. But once again, Universal's denying that anything was really lost. So it's all fine.
All fine, and I can definitely confirm that that little hard disk of setlist unedited original recordings has definitely not burnt down, unless something really bad is happening.
Well, you don't know that.
We've right got now.
we're on airplane this, at the moment. Anything could have happened.
While we're on this podcast, yes, I'm not getting emails or alerts to my phone. I'm going to touch
wood. Do you have a smart fire alarm?
Well, I think, well, maybe
someone
not.
Might tell you if your house
I
was burning
think
down.
Hopefully my landlord lives quite near where I live, so I think he would probably be aware it's burning down. I like to think that he would text me if that was happening. But touch wood, and there is wood in the studio, I can absolutely, well, I'll edit it out. If it turns out my house was burnt down, I'll edit this bit out.
Okay, so if you're hearing this now, Chris's house is fine. And more importantly, that hard disk is fine.
With the set list unedited archive
recordings. One day we'll do a, you don't really, can you do a like anniversary podcast album?
Well, podcasts are all the rage. I'm sure that's coming soon.
Yeah, so look out for that. Unless Chris's house is burnt down.
Unless my house is.
In which case, you won't be hearing this. And finally this week, DJ Khaled could be suing the compilers of the Billboard music charts in a dispute over the rules around bundling albums with merch.
Yeah, so this isn't a new debate, and it has been had with increased frequency of late, because we have started to see in recent years more and more artists, when they've got a new album coming out, bundling either the CD version or a download version with some sort of merchandise. And quite often it's a direct-to-fan thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you pre-order the album, whether that's physical or download off my website, you'll also get a ticket or a T-shirt, or you'll get access to pre-order on the next tour or something. And it has become increasingly common, and it always throws up the question of, well, do we count those bundle sales in the chart? In general, in the US with the Billboard albums chart, they are counted. But sometimes when you look at those bundles, it does sort of feel like really you're buying the merch, the T-shirt, the ticket, and you're getting a CD you don't really want thrown in,
yeah,
rather than the other way around.
Yes, yes. And so that's where there's some kind of grey area on what gets counted and what doesn't. You talk about T-shirts and tickets and things like that, but there's lots of other kind of partnerships that artists do. And sometimes it's a brand partnership. And there was a Taylor Swift album where if you bought a pizza, you got her new album on CD with the pizza.
Papa John's, if I remember rightly.
Just, I don't know if it was, the CD was just pressed into the pizza or not. But I mean, that did really seem like you're buying a pizza. You get dinner and then, oh, there's something to listen to on the CD player you probably don't own anymore. Maybe you have to go and eat your pizza in the car. That's where people still have CD players, I think. But it was, you know, it felt like there was a bit of an imbalance in the bundle there.
Yeah, so as we say, these bundles are becoming more and more common now. And DJ Khaled did a bundle with his new album,
Father of Assad,
which was released last month, I think. And if you bought the album, I think it was the digital version of the album off his website, you got some energy drink.
Because who doesn't like energy drink?
With it. So I don't know which is more desirable, an energy drink or a DJ Khaled album.
I haven't heard the album.
Take your choice.
But maybe you need kind of steel yourself to listen to it. Maybe it's a tough listen.
Maybe that's what it's for. Power your way through the listen. So that was the bundle that he did. Now, that was all up front. We all knew that was happening. And crucially, the Billboard chart counters knew that was happening. And so the story goes that his people went to Billboard chart and said, this is the bundle we're doing. It's pretty common now. You've counted everybody else's bundle sales. I assume that's going to be okay. The Billboard chart people said, yep, yeah, we're used to that. But then, the week of release, when the sales started to go out and the stats started to be accounted, the Billboard chart, in the end, rejected the stats linked to the bundle, supposedly because there was some undefined anomaly relating to the stats that came through, because the bundle was being run off this website. And so they didn't count what it has been alleged was 100,000 sales.
Yes. Which, I mean, Billboard disputes that it's anything like that number that were rejected. But that's what DJ Khaled's people are saying, and therefore saying that that is, I mean, here is the issue. That meant the album went to number two. And Tyler, the Creator's new album, Eagle, which I have heard and is very good, was at number one.
And to add some insult to the injury, Tyler, the Creator's album, which did go to number one, also had a bundle, and his bundle sales were counted. And so DJ Khaled's people's argument is, if you'd counted the 100,000 bundle sales from Khaled because you counted Tyler, the Creator's bundles, DJ Khaled's album would have been number one, not Tyler, the Creator. is the allegation.
Yes. Now, the gossip site Page Six broke this story and said that initially Khaled's people had gone to his label and complained about this, Sony's Epic label, and said, you need to put pressure on Billboard to sort this out because this isn't fair. He should have had number one. And then Sony did that and they weren't happy with the amount of pressure that was put on Billboard, which is why DJ Khaled's lawyers have now sent a legal letter to Billboard, possibly threatening further action.
Yeah, they reckoned that Sony Epic hadn't done enough to get those alleged 1,000 units of sales through the bundle reinserted into the chart. And so therefore, they've got the legal people on it. Although, as you say, this came from the Page Six gossip site. Don't really know what's in that legal letter.
No.
And I don't quite know what you would sue Billboard for. Because
just being mean.
It's just a chart, isn't it? And I mean, it's surely
yes.
Their rules that go into the making of the chart. It's not like there's any bit of law that is regulating it. I mean, a chart's a chart's a chart. And I suppose that's one of the things that various people have been saying in response to this story. It's kind of weird, isn't it, how much certain artists and certain people in the industry still really care about getting that number one record.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. If you're sitting there listening to this now and you're not thinking, who cares, then I assume you work for a record label. Otherwise, you're going to be thinking, who cares? Who even knows who's at number one? Like, I mean, the first I knew that Tyler, the Creator, had gone to number one was this story. That's what brought it to my attention. I certainly didn't know that DJ Khaled had been at number two and so hadn't thought, wow, his album must be rubbish. It only went to number two. I don't know who's at number one in any chart anywhere at the moment. And I don't care because I don't work for a record label.
Nobody cares about the music charts anymore. And Billboard chart people had already been reviewing their policy on the bundles. Because as we say, they've been kind of getting out of control.
Yeah.
And so Billboard were already looking at their rules. But, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Billboard charts in the US and indeed the music charts here in the UK, the reviews of the rules are becoming more and more frequent.
Yes.
Because with the shift from selling discs to downloads, but particularly downloads to streams, it's getting harder and harder to work out what are we even measuring. And with most of the charts now, the singles charts and the albums chart, you end up with that maths where they turn streams into sales. Because they're mashing together physical sales and download sales, but also streaming. But obviously, those are not figures that work side by side. So every chart compiler has had to come up with a rule. I can never remember what the Billboard rule is, although there's a page on our website that says it, and a lot of people come to it still every single week.
Yeah, it's confusing.
Because it's confusing, but even more.
Well, actually, the story that people come to on our website explaining the RIAA's maths on this, it's out of date because I think they've changed the rules since then.
Because they keep changing the rules. Plus, every chart around the world has come up with its own maths for working out how you match streams with downloads with sales. Of course, the Billboard Hot 100, the singles chart in America, has always mashed lots of data together.
Yeah.
Because it always had airplay data in there as well, which the main chart in the UK didn't. And then, of course, there's the whole thing on the streaming side, which is where you're giving all the streaming data equal weighting. And I know in the US, there's like, well, what about Pandora? That's more like radio. And then, I mean, the rumour always was that the chart people were being heavily lobbied by Leah Cohen, now of YouTube, saying that free streams should have the same weight as paid-for streams because it's not what people pay for it, it's the fact that they're listening. And then over here, another record industry veteran, Jimmy Iovine, with his Apple consultant hat on, saying, oh, it should only be premium streams, you shouldn't be counting free streams. And so all of this mess means the charts are kind of a nonsense anyway. So he might as well just, I don't know, write all the new releases on a post-it note, throw it in the air, and see what order they land in. It's sort of getting to the point where that would probably be as accurate as mashing together all this data, let alone the fact that really people are buying pizzas and T-shirts that they happen to get a bit of plastic with, and that's still being counted.
So that's an interesting story, and it raises lots of questions about the charts and whether or not they're nonsense. But, I mean, if it did result in legal action, it would be fascinating to see what grounds DJ Khaled tried to sue on and what further issues that raised. There won't be any legal action. I think probably he's had his shout about it now and it'll probably go away.
I have to say that the coverage of this dispute has got him way more attention than he would have got by being number one in the Billboard album.
And perhaps
and maybe that was
that
the plan.
Is the plan all along, yes. I mean, that's it, isn't it? I knew that Tyler, the Creator, had a new album out because he suddenly turned up in the UK, having been banned from entering the country several years before. And he did a big PR thing around that. And I had no idea where that album's gone to in the charts in any country, anywhere. And yet I still listen to it. I have not listened to DJ Khaled's album.
Yeah, there's always time.
No, I don't know. I think the moment might have passed.
Assuming my house hasn't burnt down, when I get home, I'm going to listen to the DJ Khaled album in full. That's what I'm going to do today.
And then write him a letter through your lawyers saying you're number one in my chart.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
And then maybe he'll send me a barrel of energy drink in return.
Well, that's really something to look forward to. I think that's it. We've reached the end. There's no more to say on anything now. If you have comments on anything we've discussed this week, perhaps you work for a record label and want to tell me that the charts matter, you can email us on setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk or tweet us at setlistpod. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.